Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, welcome to another episode of Test Talks, a podcast dedicated to all things test and automation related. I'm your host, Joe, from joecolantonio.com. In this episode, we're going to talk all about how to reduce risk with lean software testing. But first, let's hear it for our awesome sponsor, Sauce Labs. Today's episode is sponsored by Sauce Labs. Sauce Labs makes test automation awesome. Sauce's cloud-based Selenium Grid helps developers test web and mobile apps across more than 400 browser and OS platforms. Sauce also supports Appium and popular JavaScript unit testing frameworks and integrates with all the top programming languages, test frameworks, and CI systems. With built-in video recording, debugging tools, and secure tunneling for firewall testing, Sauce helps you ship better software faster. Sign up at saucelabs.com with promo code TESTTALKS14 and get 20 hours of automated testing for free. So my question today is, how many of you have been on a project where you end up building the wrong thing? Or in a company that tried a process that's currently in vogue only to see it fail? And of course, the frustration all of us have felt finding all types of bugs in our software that causes us to delay releasing it. How do we reduce these kinds of common risks associated with developing software? Matt Heuser, founder of Accelon Development, a one-stop shop for software testing and training, and the author of the book, How to Reduce the Cost of Software Testing, will share with us some context-driven principles to help guide us around some of these risk roadblocks in our software development process. Check it out. Hey, Matt. Welcome to Test Talks.
I'm pleased to be here. Thanks.
Awesome. It's an honor to have you on the show. Before we get started, could you just tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Well, that's a long story. I try to tell it tightly. I've been in technology for my entire adult life. I got a math degree with a concentration in computer science in 1997. And on the Tuesday after Labor Day weekend, started working as a programmer. I worked in an organization that didn't have any testers. And I remember my first annual review, they asked us, you know, how are you doing at various things? And one of them was, what could you improve? And I said, I kind of have a lot of bugs. And my supervisor said, bugs are going to happen. And I wasn't really happy with that. And most of the story of what I've done since is trying to do better. I went to school at night, got my master's in CIS, because I didn't have that tester safety net, and then found out that there were these things called testers that could provide services to help reduce risk, and getting exciting about that. And I did project management for a while to sort of work on the metagame to improve the skills of the team. I was a test lead for a while. And in 2011, I took my little consulting company full-time and have been doing consulting in the area of risk management ever since.
Is this how risk management relates to software engineering or projects? Can you just tell us a little bit more about what that means by risk management?
Yeah, I think you could say my whole career is a dance around risk management. And there's a lot of risks involved in software. So I've spent a lot of time doing testing. That's probably where my reputation is the most in terms of finding the defects that matter to the people that matter under time constraints and conditions of ambiguity. That's probably where I spent most of my time. The book is How to Reduce the Cost of Software Testing, which is, like, I know it's the most boring title ever. It's a collection of essays. I think I wrote four or five of them, and I was senior editor for the piece. And if I had to do it over again, I'd call it Lean Software Testing, because if you look at all those essays and kind of tilt your head and squint, that's really what comes through. And that was published in 2011. I didn't really define lean software testing as a method until 2014. So there was a lot of sort of spinning around and learning that was happening. And a lot of that was, let's give a name for these things that I'm already doing on projects that work. But risk management is all across the board now. We can look at the risk that we'll build the wrong thing, that it's not going to be fit for use. That's product risk. We can look at the risk that are injected from theory. We read it out of a book. Process that we tried to make happen on the team doesn't really work for us, and that's process risk. And of course, there's a software buggy risk. I think all of those are interesting, and I'm excited about all of them. You could think of my career as a dance around risk. I wouldn't disagree too much.
So if someone's getting involved in software testing, do you recommend that the first thing they focus on are the areas in their application that could cause the most risk? Is that how you would maybe boil it down to something really simple? Or is that just making an oversimplification?
If I didn't know anything else and had to give a context-free answer, that's probably fair. Yeah. I mean, that I would say what's needed by your team right now, figure it out and do that, which is another context-free answer, I know. But we have to dig into what problems are the teams dealing with? What kind of software are you trying to build? What are the consequences of being late versus what are the consequences of delivering the wrong thing? And you come up with a solution. I've got methods, and I teach methods, that can be applied on any kind of project to improve a specific thing. We want to improve repeatability. We want to improve reliability. Even then, you have to pick which thing you want to try to improve.
You just asked a bunch of good questions, like about a project to help a tester know what to test. So I think that's a critical skill that a tester or anyone needs to have when they work on software development. So do you have any tips around how someone can get better at asking the right questions when they're testing software?
That's a really great question. If you go to contextdriventesting.com, context-driven-testing.com, this is the principles of the context-driven school, which I belong to. And I've officially sent the email going on 10 years ago now saying I'd like to be associated with this school. So context-driven testing basically says that the context of the project defines what success is. A manager from Boeing working on avionics who was injected into a video game project for the iPhone, and a manager from that same video game project who quit and started working for Boeing, they would each bring with themselves experiences and ideas that were not good for their new environment. So I would, if someone said, I want to get good at testing, I think context is important, I want to understand how to get better at it, I would say seep yourself, indulge in the context driven software testing literature. Go to Google and type in context driven software testing. How do I do it? And see what comes back. I could probably come up with a sound bite, probably come up with a couple of things, a little nugget if you give me a little bit of time. But there's a lot to observe there.
Yeah, I mean, just having that link, I think, would be a great resource, and I'll have it in the show notes. So that's awesome.
Yeah. So, I mean, offhand, Another thing to look to is it needs work, but I think the ideas that in the Lean software testing canvas is another one you could look to. It asks questions like, how long does it take us to deploy? How many times do we want to release? What is good enough for the customer? Those sorts of questions can be helpful.
Awesome. So I guess my next question is, I guess I'm easily confused, but I hear all these terms a lot, like I'm a context-driven tester, or I'm an agile tester, or I do domain-driven testing, or lean software testing. So what is context-driven? Is context-driven something a tester can do in any given kind of software methodology? Or is it a software type of methodology that someone would apply to a project?
Well, it's really strange. I mean, if you go to, let me see if I can find it, contextdriventesting.com. The principles of the context-driven school are any practice depends on its context. There are good practices in context, but there are no best practices. Projects unfold under time in ways that are often not predictable. Product is a solution. If the problem isn't solved, the product doesn't work. None of these tell you how to do testing. Mm-hmm. Saying I'm a context-driven tester, all that's saying, in my opinion, maybe two things. One is I'm going to own my own process. I'm not going to just go in and just do what I'm told, like I'm working an assembly line, like I'm at McDonald's.
Right.
I'm high skilled, probably well compensated, hired for my expertise, and I'm going to go in and figure out what the factors are in the project and do the things that I think is going to be most valuable. Depending on management, I might negotiate what that is, of course. They might not like that, and they might want me to change, but I'm not going to be the victim of the process is the first piece. So any of the other things, lean, rapid, agile, all of the other kinds of testing, a context-driven tester could pick and choose and use what he thinks makes sense. If the whole team is aligned around agile, you might say, I'm in an agile organization, so I'm adapting to that context. I think that's okay. But he still has some autonomy there. The other piece of the context-driven school that people often miss is this idea that people working together are the most important part of any project's context. I guess the only part of the context-driven manifesto that isn't derived from pure logic, that is saying it's humanistic, people matter. You give good people a bad process, they'll fix it. You give bad people a good process, they will screw it up. So people matter. People trump process.
So I'm just trying to think in my you know, projects I've worked on. So we work on a medical device, FDA type of thing. And so the context there, the way I test that is going to be different than I would test, say, if I'm testing at Groupon. Mm-hmm. And that's okay, because I think sometimes, is context-driven also mean that, you know, agile, thou shalt do this, this, and this, but that may not apply to what I'm doing exactly, to what someone else may be doing at another company. And it's up to me to think through all the differences that may be different in my situation and then tell management or to educate people on to why we should be doing something different for our particular project.
That's a huge part of it. I think you got it there. Yeah. Now, for an FDA, and there's some research on this. If you Google four schools of software testing, Brett Petticord, maybe you can put it in the show notes. He actually came up with the Agile School, the Factory School, the Analytical School. The context-driven person says, I'm going to be responsible for my own process and figure out what makes sense to me. There are what we call exemplars. So context-driven people tend to lean toward exploratory testing and session-based test management, and there's a bunch of these little things that we tend to think about, which I find fascinating. I think it's a really good thing. As the test tools have gotten better, as WinRunner gave way to Selenium, context-driven people have started to explore and play with the tools more. I think that's good, because it says that, hey, our context is changing, the tools are better, let's start using them, and we're not as sort of married to dogma as you might be if you were told what the best practice was and you stuck with it. But we do have this kind of affinity for exploring. It's kind of the tool in our hip pocket for most context-driven testers most of the time. So one thing that I've seen happen on regulated projects is we come in and we're told, thou shalt define all test cases, print them out, and sign them with a physical pen when you have completed the test run. Therefore, you must. And it would be a kind of weak context-driven to say, okay, I guess it's the context. I got to do the thing, right? And it's different than games, so that's fine. At least when you go over to the game shop and they say, how do you test? You'd say, well, I examine the rules. So the game shop, I don't have to do that by law. I won't. There's been a few people. Griffin Jones is one. James Bach is another. Who actually in those environments said, oh, can you show me the regulation that requires me to do this? Can I read it? What does it say? Oh, it doesn't actually say that. It just says we have to have a process and follow it and provide evidence that the tests occurred. And we chose to implement that through the signature. Yeah, I don't know. That's not a good use of my time. And then negotiated a process that would provide the evidence the customer needed while minimizing the time spent documenting, because most of us actually like to test and want to spend our time actually doing testing. That's kind of a strong context-driven answer. And sometimes the answer is, nope, here's the law. This is the customer. This is the spec they gave us. And you know, if you want to keep working there, you're going to do that. But I'm amazed at what people have been able, including some of my own work, to negotiate going in with that sort of context-driven attitude.
Wow, you know, and that's just blown my mind. I'm about to go off on a rant. I work for projects. Once again, like I said, I work for FDA. And when I ask, okay, why are we doing this? Well, the FDA might ask for it. Or, but can you show me? I've asked that. Can you show me a list of what they're looking for? Oh, they can ask for anything. So we need to cover everything. And so we start doing this really weird. We start just doing things to work for a process that may not even be cared about by the FDA. But we're doing it just because we're so afraid that if the FDA comes in and says, no, you can't sell your software now, we're going to put our company in jeopardy. So it's one of those weird you know, kind of things to try to pinpoint exactly what you actually need to do in that situation.
Yeah, I worked with an architect years ago, and he actually had a strategy. And we were audited, we were HIPAA compliant, healthcare, but not FDA. And he said, if you go through an audit, and it was SAS 70 was the audit. Yep. If you go through an audit and you pass with flying colors, that means you probably did more than you were asked to do. And if you don't see business value from your extra documentation, the extra work above and beyond what you needed to do to pass is waste. So why would you do it? So what you should do is get a few severity, lowest, minimal errors on any audit that you can fix within 90 days with no consequence. If you don't get any errors, the auditors say, yep, you're good, then you've introduced waste onto the project. And there may be projects where you don't care about that. Say you're working for an aspect of the federal government and it's just, hey, we just get to bill more hours this way. That would cause me some emotional trauma. The projects that I've been on have been free market projects where if we introduce waste, we make less profit and everybody gets a smaller bonus and smaller raises.
No, that's a great point. So I know you work and collaborate with a lot of teams, a lot of companies. So how do you make it so that teams aren't playing with numbers?
Well, certainly measurement dysfunction is a real problem. I think Goodhart's law is when any measure becomes a target, you're in trouble. So if we start saying, I don't know, we're going to pay a bonus for the testers by how many bugs that you find. What you find is that the testers go for the easy and shallow bugs over the hard and the hard but important ones, right? So you find a bunch of bugs in the spelling of the about page, and each typo is a filed bug. And I've heard people say, oh, in a mature organization, that won't happen. But the reality is when you tie an incentive to a reward to a measurement, you're going to get more of the measurement. And that might not actually be what you actually wanted, which was productivity. In your particular example, I would think it's pretty easy to sidestep. I mean, depending on your role, I would say, well, you know, we found bugs. These are the bugs. Do you want us to ship or not ship? It's your choice. In one situation I was in, I actually asked out loud, do you want me to just stop filing? Do you want me to not find them? Because I'm really good at not finding them. I could leave today and just not find them. Your job as a tester is to find the bugs. What management wants to do with that is their job. So just find the bugs. So what? We found 7 bugs. Do you want to ship or not? It's up to you.
Right.
Do you want to fix them and delay shipment? It's up to you. Why is that an issue with test?
That's true. I guess maybe it's an older mindset that the QA is a quality gate almost. But in this response, you're saying here are the bugs. Leave it up to the business to decide, is this worth shipping or not, I guess.
Right. So one thing you can say there is, well, can we talk about my role? My job is to provide information to decision makers about the status of the software under test. I can't prevent the bugs. They're there, and I found them. Do you want me to not find them? And when you express it that way, there's 2 possibilities. One is the person will say, oh, of course, you know, you're enabling me to make good decisions, and I need to know what's going on. That's what you're there for. Please tell me, right? Which I think I've been fortunate to always have. Sometimes they say it reluctantly. Sometimes they say it embarrassed. Sometimes they say, man, you know, you're putting me in an awkward position, but yeah, I'd rather know. Right? That's fine. I understand. I hear things that some managers have said, I don't want to know. I want to just ship it because I want to get my bonus when it goes out on Friday. I don't think I've ever been in that position, or if I was, people knew that'd be a problem for them, so they didn't tell me. Then we can just all go home and bill and not do anything. It's when we start thinking of testing as the checkbox that we need to check so we can go to production, that causes real problems. Why test at all? I can find no bugs. Like the intro, the prelude, I forget what, the foreword, the first word in the book, How to Reduce the Cost of Software Testing, is, of course we can reduce the cost of software testing by not testing at all. Let the customers find the bugs. That's not what this book is about. This book is about reducing the cost of testing without introducing risk. And that's what I'm really interested in. So I try the sidestep on role. And if the sidestep on role doesn't work, I need to seriously consider if that's the company for me.
Right. That's great advice, great insight. So it's going to sound like I'm jumping all over the place, but I just want to revisit something.
This is fun.
So when you talked about context-driven earlier, you mentioned that one of the main tools in your toolbox is exploratory type testing. So for someone that, like I said, is really new or have a misunderstanding of exploratory testing, some people think exploratory testing, they just think it's totally unstructured, just peddling with an application without any guidance. How would you explain what exploratory testing is?
Well, it really depends on the problems that I'm trying to solve. So if someone hands me a CD or a URL and says, we want to go live in an hour, can you check it really quick? And it's a very simple form application. If you sat behind me and watched what I did, it might look to you like unstructured work. Mm-hmm. It might look to you like I'm just doing stuff. What he's just doing, that's weird. He's just looking around. Much like if you watched a grandmaster at chess and didn't really understand the game, you might have a similar thought. Yes, there's a lot happening. There's a lot, it's complex. There's a lot of modeling. We're having the modeling and the execution of the tests and the reporting and the learning about the software. They're all happening, you might say, in parallel. You might say simultaneously, or at least they're trading one off after the other. You do something, you learn about it. Based on what you learn, you conduct a different test. And to someone who isn't trained in that, it looks unstructured. I would say that they're just not trained. And that as the amount of time that you spend gets larger and you stop saying an hour, but instead start saying this is going to be a 10-sprint project and a sprint is 2 weeks long, we want to do some sort of final checking every 2 weeks before the demo. And then we're going to break the work down into small stories. You need to come up with a strategy that you may need to be able to explain and document and defend to be able to talk and think about how you are doing testing. That'll probably be significantly more lightweight than what we were talking about 20 years ago with regards to testing. And it'll let you actually explore. It'll give you the freedom to go where you think the risks are for this release. You can look at things like the change log, the features that were released, interviews with the programmers, interviews with the customers to figure out, you know, what do they absolutely have to see? What matters to them? How are they going to use it? If it's in production, you can look at the logs for how the software is actually being used to come up with the best use of that Friday before release. And that looks very different than take the requirements. For every requirement, the system shall write a test, make sure the user can, right?
Yep.
And I would argue that if you're good at risk modeling, there's a couple of great, the Heuristic Test Strategy Model has a half dozen different ways to look at all the risks on a project. If you look at that in a systematic way, you go through all the risks on the project, you identify which risks you want to do something about, you figure out the kind of things you could do about it, you stand that up against the consequences if those things break, you sort that, and you go through that until you run out of time for the amount of time you're willing to invest. That's a whole lot more responsible. That's better testing than this kind of requirements-based testing that that someone would argue is, I don't know what they call that, requirements-based testing. They think that's better because documents, I guess.
Yep. Better traceability, probably. If the FDA came in and said, where's the test that tests this requirement? They need to have the tracing saying, we have this test that traces to it and this test. So they start doing all these weird mappings, I think.
So there's a tool called session-based test management that was invented to provide you that kind of backtracing.
Oh.
What you get out of that is you get session reports. You get metrics on the number of sessions you're accomplishing per day and what requirements those trace back to. And you get bug reports. And those have been, I understand that those have been found to be sufficient evidence for a class 3 audit of an FDA medical device. So that's how I would answer that question. Like, yeah, there are things context-driven people have invented to provide that documentation.
Sweet. So along the same lines, in the book that you contributed to, Agile Testing, Learning Journeys for the Whole Team, I think you have a section where you talk about session and charters. Is that the same type of session that you just mentioned?
Yeah, and I should be very clear there. Session-based test management, to my knowledge, was invented by the Bach brothers. It's James and John Bach.
Mm-hmm.
James contributed to the Context-Driven Testing Manifesto as one of the co-authors. I didn't make it up. It's not my idea. It's a way of structuring the work to provide the evidence and provide metrics and measurements for management. I think that you can get surprisingly far these days. Like, that was invented before Agile, before extreme programming was popular, might even be invented before extreme programming. If you just do story-based testing and you document what you tested for every story, you get traceability for free.
So I've been hearing a lot about how companies are shifting left. Do you think developers can do testing, or how do you see a tester's role changing in that type of environment?
Yeah, so I teach a class called Lean Software Test, Lean Software Delivery. I started out in testing and then expanded it to cover the whole delivery cycle. It's very compatible with this shift left idea. So if I had to articulate shift left, it would be, gee, testers find a lot of bugs at the end. What if we got involved earlier in building the software right so that it was higher quality before it got to final test? And in Lean, the term that I use for that, it's a common term for that, is first-time quality. That is, the first time we do the project management, we pick the right stories. The first time we do the analysis, the stories are defined well. The first time we develop the code, all of the obvious, it should just work sort of things have been done. So that when we get to final test, we can flow through very quickly because we don't have to stop and file a bug report because login doesn't work, right? Or the whole thing is wrong. That's first-time quality. And shift left is very compatible with that because it's saying get involved with the testers earlier in the cycle so that we can improve first-time quality. Ask the questions, the hard questions. Senior testers are familiar with this where we find a bug and we go to the developer and he says, no, I'm supposed to do that. And then we go find the product owner and he says, I never thought of it that way. And we have a whole other conversation. Got to build it again. And if the developer had just known what he was supposed to build in the first place, we could have eliminated an entire find it, document it, argue about it, fix it, retest loop. And I think shift left is trying to do that. And we've been trying to do that for 30 years. But there was a conference in the 70s. Bill Hetzel wrote his book, the first book on testing. Might have been the 60s. Chapel Hill Conference. I think there were probably ideas in there to shift left. What I think has happened in the last 15 years, which is really good, is that we've popularized ideas that are practical for how to do it besides have reviews and argue about things, because that just turned out to be a big waste. So test-driven development and unit tests are just a fantastic way for programmers to improve code quality before it gets a human exploring. And on top of that, I would say that whether you call it acceptance test-driven development or you call it behavior-driven development, or you call it specification by example, whatever you want to call it, this idea of breaking the work down into small chunks and then having developer, tester, graphic designer, product owner get together and talk about what it's going to look like and build a shared understanding before the code is written to prevent that stupid argument, I think that's a really good thing. And if you want to call that shift left, that's great.
Are there any books or resources you would recommend to testers to help them with software testing?
Oh, so much. I mentioned James Bach before. He did a lot of pioneering work. His website, satisfice.com, he has a blog off there. He has his heuristic test strategy model, and his slides for his class, Rapid Software Testing, are available for free, if I recall correctly. Lee Copeland has a book on test design. It's really, really good. It's a shallow coverage of a bunch of test techniques. It's a fun read, so that might be something to look at. Dr. Kaner's got a site called testingeducation.org, and a lot of that material, I think maybe all of it, is online there for free download. You just don't get a proctored instructor, and you don't get the sort of community sharing. Publish something once or twice a month for CIO.com. You could go read those. Those are mostly high-level manager, but they're thinking about the software development process. I think it's important for testers to be able to communicate up to customers, to be not just sort of stuck in our cubes and I click the thing and write the bug report, but instead position ourselves as advisors when possible.
Excellent resources. Could you just tell us a little bit more about your consulting company?
Yeah, we started in 2011 with me doing on-site, full-time, long-term, six-month contracts, doing testing and helping others do it. And I still do a little bit of that. We have other people on the team now that do a lot of that. So we do actual testing. We do
consulting and training. So it's very common. I want to work with a larger organization. They bring me in for a day or two, three. I interview people. There's often a strategic objective, like we want to get into test tooling. We want to reduce our time for regression testing. We're having this particular problem, and can you help us? Too many bugs are getting to production, whatever the problem is. They write an assessment, and at the bottom of that, it'll have ways we could work together, and then we talk about, you know, what makes sense as a follow-up. Should I be on site 1 week a month for 6 months? Should we do some training? A common training class that I offer is my lean software delivery, lean software test courses. Those are from 1 to 3 days. The one-day versions typically focus on the lean tools, which are ways to identify waste in the software process and to measure our performance in a predictable way that doesn't cause dysfunction, and then see performance go up. And that typically leads to more releases more often with less time testing and higher first-time quality. The doing of testing through contracting, the consulting, the training, and we do a little bit of placement and a little bit of writing for software companies, actually. That's pretty much all our offerings.
Awesome. Are you going to be speaking at any conferences coming up that people can catch you?
Yeah, sure. My company's organizing Test Retreat Grand Rapids, August 1st in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Then I won't be speaking. Test Retreat's an open space, unconference. We create the schedule the morning of. I will propose sessions there. And it's going to depend on who the audience is. If the audience is very senior, we'll be proposing sessions on lean and running some exercises that are sort of my cutting edge, new stuff that I'm developing. If it's more junior, I'll be proposing, you know, what is context driven or introduction to context, how can I learn kind of stuff, introduction to quick attacks. A lot of those sessions turn out to be conversations, not traditional presentations, and that's fine. After Test Retreat on Monday, I'll be I'm the program chair for CAS, the Conference for the Association for Software Testing. And after that conference, I fly out Wednesday night to go to DC for the Agile Conference, Agile 2015, where I'm the track chair for the enterprise track. In the fall, I think I'm going to Agile Vancouver to do a day of lean. And then I'm going to go to Kitchener-Waterloo, probably, to do some training at their conference. And I'll be in Potsdam, Germany in November for Agile Testing Days. I think that's most of them. So it's going to be a busy fall.
So Matt, before we go, is there one piece of actionable advice you can give someone to improve their testing efforts? And let us know the best way to find or contact you.
My website is xndev.com. And I'm M-H-E-U-S-S-E-R. That looks like M. Huser on Twitter. One piece of advice. See, this is, we're going back to best practices, right? We're going back to what's the one thing that everyone should know. And the whole context-driven thing is, it really depends. I would say, what does my team need right now? What? And there's a couple of ways. So I'll tell a little story, the true story. I was working for a larger company. And a manager was on a rampage, and he would write, "Know your role, be your role," on the whiteboard in big letters. I think there were some political things going on at the time. But I would take a marker. This is a whiteboard. I just take a marker, and I would write in little letters beneath it, "Figure out what needs to be done for the team right now, and do that." So in other words, focus less on role than on filling the gaps. I think if you do that, you're never going to have to worry about having a job, because it's a gap. And if people see it, when the layoff time comes and the axe man comes, and people will say, what can we do? Like, who can we cut? Well, we can't cut Sally, because without her, thing. And that's a position of scarcity. That's a position of, ooh, I'm worried about the layoff. If that's where you're at, that's a good way to start. If you're not there and you're like, hey, I could get any job I want, I have skills, then figure out what's the next thing for you and start doing that. I guess that's advice. But my answer is it depends. Oh, one more thing I just heard this week. I think it's real and actionable. If you find yourself in an interview where you're asked a very specific question that seems to you to be odd and they want a very specific answer, like, What's the difference between smoke testing and stress testing, right? And they're terms that are, that's even, those are kind of defined terms. Maybe like, give me an example of gray box testing, where like, you know, there's no real definition for that, right? There's no agreed upon definition for gray box testing. And you start to say, well, it depends. When I hear that, I think this. What do you think? And you're not getting a response. You're getting like stone cold, like, no, just tell us the answer, right? There's one answer. It's our answer. And it doesn't really have anything to do with testing. It doesn't really have anything to do with, right? It's not really about the job. It's about memorizing a list of terms that you might or might not have access to. And when you try your duck and groove move where you say, well, I might know it by a different name, and it doesn't work. Remember, an interview works two ways. They might be failing your interview. It might not be you. It might be them. And don't do something that gets you the job you don't want to have. So there's the second piece. So much of what we do in life is driven by scarcity and fear, right? I've been in that place when I was younger. Look, man, I just want a job. You just give me a job. And I look back at, what was the outcome of that interaction? Was I happy with that? Why was I motivated by fear? Did I really not believe that if I didn't get this job, something better would come along later? And again, maybe you're in that environment. Maybe you are really that. There are probably people listening to this podcast that work in countries that don't have a social safety net, that are different. But from where I'm sitting here today, operating out of fear hasn't done me any favors.
Thank you, Matt, for your context-driven lean software testing awesomeness. For links to everything of value that we talked about in this episode, head on over to testtalks.com/61. And while you're there, make sure to click on the more info link under the exclusive sponsors section to learn all about Sauce Labs' awesome products and services. Also, I would love it if you had a second to leave a review in iTunes. They go a long way in terms of helping the show reach more people, and it really does help in the rankings. So that's it for this episode of Test Talks. I'm Joe, and my mission is to help you succeed with automation awesomeness. As always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.